listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kolula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
We're gonna jump right into this episode. We have a very talented musician. I actually just saw his band this weekend, Mr. Aaron Steinberg. How are you, Aaron?
I'm good, my man. How are you?
Dude, I was very impressed with your band. Super funky, super badass, just way funky players, just awesome musicians, awesome musicianship. Tell me, when did you first learn to play guitar? What was the moment of zen that made you want to become a musician?
The moment of zen is I was already taking piano lessons, but my friend up the block could play the guitar. So that meant he could go anywhere and be a musician. But if you played a piano, no piano, you're a nut. So he showed me how to play a few chords on the guitar, and that was the end. Off I went.
And I saw you had a keyboard stage with you. Do you always have both ready to kind of play?
Yeah, kind of. Well, we added that a little while ago, Keith Eady, who plays in the band, he's often had his bass synth and vocoder and other keys. And I thought, why don't we just double the fun and make this just an onslaught? So, you know, why not?
Well, you got like synthy sounds. And then he had like, I think he was telling me he had the Moog. What is it? What did he call it? He called it the Moog Defender or something like that. I can't remember the model that he said, but
Sounds like a 70s video game.
Yeah, totally. But I mean, you guys had such a cool sound. How did you guys meet and kind of, you know, talk about this sound of what you wanted to put together to make this band?
Well, it's kind of crazy, man. I came here from New York some years ago. And fairly soon after, I started playing with Juice, Roger Juice Benford, who's the drummer that you saw.
He was awesome.
Yeah, he's amazing. He plays with artists like Sir, who you definitely know. And so he and I were playing around for a long time. And coincidentally, we had both separately played with Keith on different gigs. Another guy playing with us who couldn't make the gig recommended Keith as a sub. And I think we all felt right away like, okay, this is something. We just, you know, some people just have a chemistry. And that was it for us.
And he also played with Macy Gray. Was that right? Did I see that correct?
So
did he tour with a bunch of artists? And then he's just like, yo, I want to do an original project that's like funky and just showcases what I do. Because I know how it is, like with all these big, you know, artists, they always have these great players and they don't throw down like I know they can in all these acts. But what I like about your band is you all threw down like start to finish. You had interpolations of songs. You had great originals. It was just super funky, well arranged. So it must have been like, yo, we want to do this and throw it out in a way that kind of shows off what we can do as a funk band, right?
Well, thanks. You know it, man. It means a lot coming from you. You have a wealth of experience. You know, playing with people like Tony Levin, that doesn't suck.
I know. That's been like the newest thing, and man, it's been like a dream come true. But you know this, you know, like playing with a great bass player, man, as a guitar player, there's nothing better than playing with a great bass player because it is the foundation, you know? So when I saw you guys, I was like, both these guys are just killer musicians. And there's so much interplay between you both. I mean, there must be moments where you're just like, well, we can do this and we can do this in the arrangement and then we can do this. How do you kind of find that perfect balance of like,
you know, well, coming back to what you just said, you know, Los Angeles and New York are full of great musicians, great touring musicians, but they don't always have a situation that allows them to use all their talents, all their knowledge, all their abilities, all the parts of their personalities.
Right.
So in our three-piece band, there's room for that, and we encourage that. So I think we look kind of to see what we might pull out of the other guys. What crazy tangent can I kind of nudge you to go on? You know, so the conversation, like you noticed, it's part of the fun. You know, it's part of the deal.
And do you guys all, I assume, had very similar influences. Were there any artists that you didn't know that was an influence on the other?
Yeah, there's a few. There's always surprises. Obviously, we have many things in common, which I'm sure are many of your favorites too, if I'm not mistaken. You know, Prince,
Parliament, absolutely.
Jimi Hendrix, James Brown, duh. But, I know Tim, Keith, I know he's fond of Tom Misch, who's a cool artist, M-I-S-C-H.
Know him. I don't know Tom Misch.
Yeah, I didn't know him either, but I'm sure you will dig. And I know that Juice is a fan of John Scofield, which you kind of thought, but I think he's definitely a favorite for Juice. But I think there's a lot of oddball, you know, all things we all have in our sort of musical collection that may be a surprise. And so like a while back, he started singing this song at a gig by the band Snow Patrol, Chasing Cars, which we did the other night.
Yep.
No one thinks he's going to do that. And that's just why it's so fun to trot that out.
Well, you did a cool version, too. That's what's neat. It's like you didn't make it like, okay, we're going to do this tune this way. You kind of made it your own, which also had like an even like more badass backbeat and groove with that rhythm section than the original song. So it's like, you definitely know like when to turn it up. You know, let's go back to the days when you were in New York. Were you in the city or were you upstate? Okay, so you were in the city. So when you were learning guitar, what players were you gravitating towards? Was it Jimi Hendrix, Stevie Ray Vaughan? Did you start with the blues or did you kind of go into the funk right away?
Sure, it was all of those things because, you know, they overlap so much.
Right.
Obviously, Nile Rodgers, everyone has paid attention to that guy. And, you know, but also to songwriting, people like the Beatles and Bill Withers. And, you know, I think that the song, this may not be the expected thing, but the song is the foundation. And if the underlying song isn't there, you're kind of got nothing. So, you know, I like Roberta Flack and Billie Holiday are people like Sam Cooke and people I will look to.
Dude, you and I are live because you said that. Like, I always feel that. It's like the song has to be at the core of everything for me because, man, players can play. You can have jazz songs or soul songs that, like, are so great, but the songs aren't there, and it just loses me. It's like you have to have a story. You have to have a melody. It has to be, like, perfectly, like, constructed. I don't care if it's a seven-minute song or if it's a three-minute song, or if it's a five-minute song, it just has to be built well and take the listener on a journey. What were some of those early record experiences like for you when you were exploring music?
Oh, let's see. Well, there's a few songs by the Spinners that I liked when I was young, like Whenever You Want Me, I'll Be There, I'll Be Around. That song, that's a two-chord song, but man, wouldn't you like to have written one of those?
I know.
You know, everything by the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, of course, Sam Cooke. Like I said, those songs are really simple, but try writing one that simple, that good.
I always say that to like whenever like I hear like a jazz artist or anybody talking about a rock song or a pop song, like, oh, it's just a rock or a pop song. I'm like, write it. Write me one. You know what I mean? Like when you can write a hit that's so simple and accessible and hooky and catchy, I mean, there's an art to that. I really feel like the finest of the arts to make something memorable that's so simple, and especially if it's short. You know what I mean? If it's 3 minutes, 4 minutes, and it can be interesting in that amount of time, I feel like that is, you know, such a hard thing to do. I think the Beatles did it the best. I think James Brown did it the best. I think Stevie Wonder is one of those, like, icons that always transforms the art form, you know? So it's amazing to see that. I'm going to ask you a tough question. Who are those artists for you now? Like the current artists? And I'm sure they're under the radar. It's like, you know, maybe artists that people don't know about, but who are those artists for you that are kind of making your head turn a little bit?
Well, this is newer. Daniel Caesar, I like very much. just as far as singing ability, it's hard to sing better than Lettucey. I mean, Bruno Mars is very gifted at what he does.
Yes, I agree.
No, in every aspect, I would say. A guy who's still going that you guys that is very under the radar is Jean-Paul Borelli. Who?
I don't know him.
You do, my man. That's more great. People know his daughter, Bibi, but he was in New York back when I was. And wow, that sure changed my approach to songwriting and playing and groove and the whole concept. And the idea of mixing styles, it's okay to have rock, jazz, blues, psychedelic shit all come together in a way that's new. His brother was a big producer. In fact, he produced some stuff for people like Bell Biv DeVoe and stuff like that.
Wow. Okay. All right. That's another era of music that I also love too. That new Jack Swing that you could tell Bruno Mars was super influenced by when he had like the Living Color video and all of that. You know, it's like when you were kind of discovering guitar, when did you start writing and what style did you start writing in initially?
Man, well, you know, I was limited. I started even writing on the piano, so I was kind of limited to what I could do. But I was a fan of things like Beatles and Stevie Wonder, so I wanted to see if I could write like that. So I tried, you know. And then, you know, the piano you write one way maybe, and then a guitar you write another way. And I still admire the Beatles and Stevie Wonder as much as I did then.
In fact, I would probably, and I'm sure you would agree, it's like, as I make more records, as I write more songs, those artists become even greater. Because it's like, I look at them and say, wow, they were doing this on analog tape. They were doing this with 16 tracks or 24 tracks instead of infinite tracks and infinite ways to edit those tracks. You know, it's just like, but on the flip side, they also had, you know, labels backing them where they were like, spend 2 months in the studio, whereas artists today, we're not on those kind of budgets. You know, it's like we're trying to get in and out as fast as we can and just make something special or work remotely. Speaking of which, for your records, how do you guys kind of record? Do you record remotely and send things back and forth? Do you do things all in the same room? How does it work?
We've done both. We've done, you know, sometimes we've done a lot sort of jingles or soundtrack music where we'll do that, but there's no way to improve on being there together, as you know.
Yes.
So when we're doing rhythm tracks for the record, we get in the same room and do it. Overdub the vocals because we don't know how to make that not sound like shit at the same time.
And do you write the song, write them together? How does that work?
Frequently, sometimes Keith and I will write together. Sometimes I'll come in with one or he might. But the arrangement will – the song takes on a new thing when the three of us are together, as you know. So it can really transform. And in fact, you don't want to be rigid when you come in. You're like, I wrote the song, it must go like this. Well, maybe not.
Right.
If you trust the people you're with, they only want to make it better. They're not looking to like, oh, I got to play a 6/8 beat here or else.
Right. Well, and it's the other thing too. It's like you're making room for magic. You know, there's something about, do you, and this is something I always think about. Do you guys, like, you start writing the song and you initially just start recording right away? Or do you kind of like let it season for a little bit, road test it maybe a little bit? Like, how do you, what's your creative process when it comes to that?
If you're able to do that, if you're able to road test it, as I'm sure you found yourself, man, you can really iron out the kinks. Like, okay, everyone goes to sleep on that bridge. Let's fix that.
Yep.
Or, you know, the whatever it is, a song doesn't need a solo or all those kind of learning things, or the tempo or the feel, all those kind of things. Being in a room again with other humans tells you stuff that you can never sit there with, you know, without them and determine, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I also find, like, you know, there's this, you know, like I'll record rehearsals a lot, you know, because I think like those are important ways to kind of have a sketching pad, you know, to kind of like get an idea of where the song can go. And there are times where I'm like, man, I wish we were in a studio where we were just laying this stuff down without thinking about it, because there's magic in that process. And like, you end up recreating it as it, you know, gets kind of ironed out over time. But there is something that whenever I hear a band, they're like, we wrote it that day and recorded it that day, I'm always like, oh, that sounds fun, because I usually don't do it like that unless it's a remote session and everybody's kind of working, you know, like remotely where they can iron out their parts individually. But when it all comes together in the moment, like as you're writing, I also think there's a cool energy with that, which I've never really done. I always am like, no, let's wait. Let's like rehearse it and make sure we know the arrangement so that we can go in and just track it on one or two takes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lot to that. We've all done things where we rush it and like, damn, 2 months later, you record it again because that first one was the wrong tempo or the wrong feel. I don't know. So most of the time, you know, if you can get it right by doing it a bit, there's something to that. Not every time. And if it comes, luckily, if it comes quickly, you know, lucky you, man.
Right. I mean, it also seems like, you know, you kind of know where a song should feel. So when you, when is that like right tempo for you? Is it where it's like, it just feels pocket, or when it's like that perfect amount of energy where it has a little bit of push? Because I'm always like back and forth between those two.
I don't know if that's the right answer. If it's too lazy, it's easy to play, but it sounds a little limp. If right. it's rushed, that's no good. So right. I look for, as I look to push it a hair bit, depending on the song. So it's a fine line. I don't know. We'll sit there for half an hour and click between 2 or 3 BPM. And to me, it can sound kind of different if we're using a click.
Right. Oh, that brings me to the question I was going to ask you, like, do you always use a click? Because I've gone, I'd say 95% of my records are always to a click, but there have been a couple times where, like, you know, for a blues trio record I did, we actually tempo mapped it. So we just played it live, and then we tempo mapped each section. And if it was off by like half a beat or something, it just felt all right. Like we would edit where it, you know, needed to be right, but it also didn't lose feel. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting approach. And, you know, I was having this debate with a friend of mine talking about Zeppelin records because they never used a click. And all those records feel so good. And it's like nothing feels rushed or out of time, but they're all in time with each other. So like, do you ever experiment with no click, and how is that editing process for you? Because I always pull out my hair during it.
Yeah, yeah. Editing without the click is a nightmare. So we do a few songs without it. There's a fast one, sort of almost punk rocky on our record that click just wasn't going to work. And so it was great to turn it off. I personally enjoy a click. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't feel rigid. To me, at this point, I do like background television and film music, so I have to use a click. So that doesn't freak me out having a click. It doesn't feel restrictive. But there are some songs that don't like it, or some sections that don't like it. So I've even done a thing where we get to the solo section and the click comes off.
Right.
It's weird. That's not even a tempo map. It's just kind of goodbye now.
You potentially for the solo.
Yeah, sometimes if you want the solo to kick in with some energy, with some gusto, like, okay, we can just try to do the solo out without it. So I don't know. I don't know if I have a great answer for that tough but interesting question.
Yeah, you know, it's like it's one of those I think about all the time, because it's like I've play with drummers that they want to play with a click. They just want it to be like ingrained in. And what I like about the click is it's a barometer for everybody. And it's like, you can tell editing, you know, when you need to edit, it's so easy. But at the same time, you know, I think about all those records that I love that don't use a click. And like, I'm surprised more and more when I'm like, oh my God, this is off. Because like, nobody, if you think about it, and I'm sure you've had this thought, like nobody ever listens to a record and they're like, let's make sure it's at BPM 89 because I have a feeling there's a little bit of movement. Nobody does that. It's like, does it feel good or does it not? And it's like, that's the thing that I constantly battle with the click. It's like, is this going to work or is it not? And it's like, I feel like great players can bounce around the click in a way. They kind of dance around it. And I find that those are the players I love to play with the most. That kind of, it's like the groove is just inherent and you're kind of like making it, you know, fun. Like play to something, but I always think about those records that weren't recorded to a click that just feel good. And it's just like, you know, has the right ebb and flow and movement in the right, you know, like the Stones, for example, They weren't playing to a clique. They were playing to each other. And, like, those songs are epic. Those songs are so legendary. Beatles, too. I'm sure half of those songs were not
a clique. No.
Yeah, so it's like, it's just crazy to me. And I also feel like it's there's somebody along the way that's like, no, we need to do this to a clique. And then everybody kind of falls suit because this is what we've learned. I mean, I've done 95% of my records to a clique, and I rarely do anything without a clique. So I always wonder about, oh, is this better to do it this way? So that's my question to you.
I think it's a great question to ask and to keep asking.
Right.
It sounds like, okay, or if you have time, and I think it's money well spent for an extra hour of studio time to get the tempo that works, whatever it is, try a few with a clique, try a few without, listen back. Go with what's working. You know, if you're spending more money, man, this is what you care about. Spend the damn money, pay the engineer, and see, maybe the clique is fine, but maybe it's not the best. Or maybe it's great.
we do like these film scenes for this YouTube series. Like, I've sent you some of the videos, and man, we always have to use a clique because there could be a solo on take three that's out of sight, and the whole band is grooving on take four, and it's so easy just to be like, let's take the solo from this. But 9 times out of 10, we want the whole take to be there. But it's if there is something that can be used, it's a nightmare to do without a clique. So it's just hard. But I always think about those bands that just were playing without it, and it just always feels good. And I feel like rehearsals, I never play to a clique in rehearsals. So rehearsals have that energy. So I'm always like, maybe we should just do it without any edits and just get the take right. So it's something I always think about. That's why I was
asking. I would say keep thinking about it. Keep asking that question. You know, your version of Baby I'm a Star doesn't feel rigid. It feels great. So clique wasn't in the way that time.
Oh, that's right. Again,
that song wants to sit there.
Yeah. It's already like, believe fast tempo, like it's an upbeat tune, but even some of the Prince stuff is not, like, you know, that original song is actually a little bit sloppy, or like Driven to Tears by the Police. I know the Police are a huge influence, man. It kind of blew my mind when I saw the tempo, like Stuart Copeland rushing on the kick. I was like, oh my god, how is this on a record? This is crazy. And it's like one of their best songs, you know what I mean? So I love that you're influenced by them too, by the way, because
Yeah.
It's one of the best trios, one of the best, you know, guitar players, bass players, melody makers, and drummers all put together. So were you always highly influenced by trios?
I kind of like trios. I guess the first one I noticed was probably Jimi Hendrix. And then, yes, absolutely, the Police, you know. I just like the idea of a three-ring circus is kind of fun. You know, if you think about it, keyboards are guitar, bass, drums, vocals. Those are the core elements of a lot of pop music. So what if we just roll with those?
Yes. I have to show you this because I just went to Seattle and I got this Hendrix book.
Wow.
If you haven't seen or read this book, it's the best Hendrix book I've ever seen. We'll have to get together and I'll bring it because you will love it. It's like it details his life before he became Jimi Hendrix. So there's all these things about his life and how he kind of grew up. And like, it's just things that you just didn't know. I didn't know. And I know so much about him. So I love those stories about the people that were so heavily influenced by. Hendrix seems to be that terminal. As a guitar player, I think I keep going through to kind of like go back and listen to some of the things that he did that were just so righteous, you know? So what is your favorite Hendrix song, by the way?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Well, his Crosstown Traffic might be it, or Drifting, or Little Wing, duh. Maybe his version of All Along the Watchtower, which Bob Dylan is the author of.
So I love May This Be Love. That's one of my favorites.
We do a cover of that one.
Oh, man. Dude, man, you got to make a video of that. That's one of my favorite Hendrix tunes ever. It's so good.
Good call on that one, man. Not everyone thinks about that.
Man, I love that. So, I mean, I kind of, like, whenever I've covered Hendrix, I cover Hendrix with my blues trio. Man, we do, like, the big hit Hendrix songs. But I always think about that song because it's just, like, arrangement wise, it's kind of unbelievable, and it's just like one of the most epic Hendrix tracks. And he's still, I have to introduce you to an engineer of mine because he played Monopoly with Jimi Hendrix. He used to be Van Morrison's guitarist, and
whoa,
he met Hendrix twice, but one of the times he ended up playing Monopoly with him. And when he tells the story, it's so funny because he's like, man, that motherfucker, he got Boardwalk on the first time around the board. Like, he's still bitter about it, but it's so funny because, you know, like, it's so funny because it's like, yo, you're playing Monopoly with who? Like, it's like, this is crazy. It's a crazy story. Right. But yeah, it's like, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, it kind of tripped me out when he told me the story. And then fast forward, my girlfriend actually brought a Guitar Player magazine home from the 90s from her boss. And, you know, he gave it to me because he knew I loved Hendrix. And I was reading through it, and it was an interview with his sister. And she was like, well, you know, they were like, what was your biggest memory of your Jimmy? And she said, you know, I didn't really know him that well because he was always on tour. But she said, whenever he came home, he always loved playing Monopoly. So I was like, oh my God, the dude loved Monopoly. This is so crazy. So yeah, it's a very random story. Okay. So you guys have made records and recordings. You guys are playing shows. Tell me like how your creative process works when you want to release something. Like, how do you choose what the single is? How do you choose the first song that you're going to push?
That's a really tough question. And you don't know going into it. You might think song B is it, and then when you're done, you're like, God damn, song A is the one. I think just the thing that seems to have the most universal reach out and grab people thing, I'll ask friends and people like that, like, hey, which of these are you feeling? But the truth is, you kind of know ahead of time, which more frequently, which is the most fun, the catchiest, the hookiest, I think. For our last one we did, the song was called Holly, which we didn't actually get to the other night, but we will get to it next gig. We made a ridiculous video for that, which extended the fun of it, you know. I guess you just look for something that feels universal, I guess.
That's awesome. Well, let's play something from you guys. What do you want to play first?
Well, why don't we go for that one, since I just mentioned it.
What's the name of the title?
The song is Holly, H-O-L-L-Y, Holly.
Here's Holly by Captain Dangerous.
Something does a man do to make love for you? And what does a man have to prove? Something does a man do to make love for you? And what does a man have to prove? Holly, she's not she might cry. Why? She never lets me know. Something does a man do to make love to you? And what does a man have to prove? So what does a man do to make love to you? And what does a man have to prove? Holly, stepped out of a dream, yeah, but Holly, just the same, she'll never know just what she means. Oh, hate to see her go. Something does a man do to make love to you? Get the feeling.
That was awesome, dude. Such feel good music.
Thank
I
you,
have to
man.
Ask, you must have Fishbone as one of your influences.
Oh, of course.
Because I hear so much in that. I heard so much Fishbone in that. It's just like, dude, so funky. Just so great, man. Such a feel good song. I want to ask you a gear question. What is the wah that you're using on that?
Fun question, my man. You'll enjoy this. So Ibanez made one called the Demon and the Demon Junior. And the fun thing about this one is you, for people who don't know, the wah-wah pedal, wow, like Shaft, to turn it on and off, you have to do an extra thing where you click a button to then make it on or off. And sometimes you don't know which it is. So this sucker, you lift your foot off, you're not wah-ing anymore.
It's, what? Are you
yes. So go
this
grab
like,
one.
This is my dream of the wah pedal.
Me
this
too.
Is so crazy. Dude.
So otherwise, you got one more stupid thing to do. Got to try to click off it on the beat so you don't screw yourself up if you're singing, as you are.
Yep.
So Ibanez, Demon Wah or Demon Junior. And it sounds really good.
How does it turn on and off then?
It has some light sensing electric eye Big Brother thing. It's made years ago.
That's so crazy because I've been thinking about this for years, actually, that it drives me crazy. I've got a Vox wah. I've got a
Crybaby.
Picture wah, a Crybaby. I've got a the Real McCoy picture wah is what I was talking about. And then I've got a Crybaby Jr. Have you seen those?
Yes, they're awesome.
Those are awesome. I saw Kingfish, and he was playing one, and I was like, man – this is such a cool little. I gotta get one just because it's
good
so,
enough for him. Good
yeah,
enough.
For yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, it's also like it doesn't take too much real estate on the pedal board. That's another thing. Like usually wahs are super heavy and they're super just like they're just. But I love them too. It's like how could you not?
No,
you know,
yeah.
You know, it's like it's just part of it. So
there may be a Crybaby. One of them, I think, does have that same thing where you don't have to click it. I don't have that one. But
you just love that. I'm so glad I asked that question because I always think about that. I'm like, why have that? It should have been an invention like 10 years ago. It's so bizarre that it's just old technology still,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. So I'm going to have to check that out. That's amazing. What was the influence behind the song?
You know, it was like I wrote it some years ago. It's a misconnection. You know, sometimes you feel, and it has a broader sense, but sometimes, you know, you feel like with people, you're two ships that pass in the night. You never really understood each other. And it's not the end of the world because life is full of that, but there's just a little something melancholy about that. And just picked up the guitar and there it was, you know.
That's awesome. But it's super catchy. It's still in my head. Let's talk about some of your TV credits. You wrote, so did you write the theme song for Bill Nye the Science
Guy?
Not the
famous one, but Bill and I have done a number of couple things, a little series for Disney, Solving for X, and some other ones too. In fact, just very day, he got his Hollywood star.
I saw that, and I was like, man, he should have had that like 20 years ago, let's be honest, because he's been a staple in every kid's lives for the last 30 years just because he's Bill Nye the Science Guy. So how awesome to be able to collaborate with him. Is he also a musician? Does he like?
He loves music, and we threatened to do a album of science themed songs.
Awesome!
I haven't given up on that. I hope he has. You know, he's for some reason he's busier than ever,
wow.
Which is that's great. Cool. We need him out there, man.
Yeah.
So
he should be like refuting all of the bullshit, like. Science that people are quoting that is not backed by any science.
And he is. That's what he does kind of all day long, where it's climate change or every other misconception that's provably false. He has to try to weigh in on this. So he just keeps going on it. So he's full steam ahead with that.
Do you wear like a hat when you're composing for visual media? Tell me what that process is like for you.
Yeah, well, it's a different beast in some ways. Obviously, there's a lot of crossover sonically or whatever, but and it's almost as though when you're scoring something, the picture, the story, is the lead vocal, and you have to provide the background for that, which is sometimes very little, sometimes it's a lot. So you want to be you're there to support that. You're there to do what that needs to do, and you're there to underscore emotional shifts twists and turns. That's what music does. It's not just to keep you awake if you're nodding off. You know, it's supposed to support the emotion.
But I'm sure there are times where you get notes that are not music directed, where you're just like, how do I make this more red? I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, more red. Well, one thing that's kind of funny is if you're not a musician, you can kind of mix up tempo or louder and softer, bigger, smaller, slower and faster.
Right.
If someone wants something slower, I think that means more minimal and more laid back, maybe not slower.
That's
one code thing. A musician, if you say slower, you're going to slow down the tempo. But right. That may not be what they mean. So your job is, but if you're scoring something, your job is to be a translator. What does this person mean? They're not the musician, you are.
Right.
As long as for them to say, don't use a trumpet, use a trombone. That's you. That's on you.
Well, I mean, it's also like you're interpreting. But sometimes I feel like I wish that people would just trust musicians a little bit more, just to like, what do you think works for this? And then it's like, maybe less direction. Maybe it's like, oh, this is good. Let's build on this and see where it can go. Because that's another thing. They like, I know sometimes you give them the bones, you know, of an idea. And it's like, they may think that it is finished. And it's like, well, this is not, I'm trying to see if you're going to like it first before I put all my eggs in one basket. And then you tell me to redo everything. You know what I mean? So
it's really hard. One way around that, if you are friends, you're finding scoring things and you're like, oh my God, you can, one trick is to score a short piece the way it should sound, but maybe it's just a short bit, and see how that goes over. That can be a way to, because they may not be able to hear like, oh, this melody sounds great when you quadruple it.
Right.
You know? So one way is try a little piece.
Right.
The other bear is what is a temp score or a temp track. Sometimes everyone will get attached to that. And even if they didn't like it initially, they're used to it. So now you're all, you have this ghost of this thing in there to all have to navigate.
The demoitis.
Yeah, and maybe they didn't like it at first, but now they're used to it. Another kind of oddball thing, I've got to talk to Harry Gregson Williams, who scores huge movies, and even something with someone at his level, he'll have a thing where they've temped in something he's done before, they're used to it, and now he's like, damn, now he has to, you know, he's got to deal with a ghost of his own score. So that's, I understand why they would do that. There's got to be something there, but it's a balance. Don't, you know, use it as a thought process, not get stuck on it. So it can be a thing to untangle for everybody.
Well, it's such a respect for film composers, TV composers, any visual media, because it's like, man, it is a very, I think it's an under-recognized talent, and the depth of what it takes to get it done is so detailed that people overlook it, I think, a lot of times. So whenever I hear somebody's doing that, I'm like, man, you're a monster already, because you have to be. It's like, you can't just be like skimming the top to get by. It's like, you have to know transpositions most of the time, arrangements for strings, arrangements for orchestrations. Like, it's a lot of things, you know, or just knowing, oh, I can make this work with a minimalist approach and it's still going to hit. You know what I mean? So
that's a great point. In fact, being minimal, man, that works so often. Try muting a few of those things you did that were so fancy but are obscuring.
Right. It's easy to indulge. You know, it's like I find that I sometimes love to indulge, and sometimes it's like, yo, I don't want any of it. I want just acoustic guitar or something really simple, one or two instruments, and that should carry it. But man, it's fun to have people playing stuff all together. Like, there's something exciting about that. Or it's fun to layer stuff all together. You know what I mean? There's something that's magical about that. So
there's not one right answer. The
right.
thing is trying to be open to all those possibilities. Maybe you need a 70-piece orchestra. Maybe you need a ukulele.
Did you go to or anything like that to study this?
Yeah, I studied a bit, but you know what, man? There's nothing is like doing it.
Yes.
There's nothing like doing it, and there's just no way around. And the technology changes so much, you need to be hit with that, and you can't be afraid of that. You know, you got to be ready for the next thing. You know, AI is, of course, the monster on the horizon for all of us. But maybe we can just cling on to what we do that AI is not going to do.
Well, I was, you know, I have these discussions a lot with people, especially musicians. It's like AI can only reproduce what's already been done. It cannot innovate or create something new unless it's a combination of two things that are already done. And it just sounds like a middle of the row combination instead of something that has nuance and style and kind of a, you know, vibe. I think AI doesn't generate that. Like, there's something about an artist that can take two things and make it something new and disguise it so well that AI does not know how to do yet. It's like AI can do the dance that's already been instructed for it to do, but it can't innovate a step. And I think that's the difference between the creative mind and the technological advancements with AI. But it is scary. I will say, I worked on an animated music video for a song of mine, and it took us 4 years to make a 3-minute animated project. And now you can make, we're about to release another AI animated project, and it took us like 2 weeks to do the 4-minute project. And it's like that, you cannot, like, you can't beat that. It's just unbelievable. It was so much cheaper, it was faster, and it's like, it doesn't look as good as the one that took 4 years, but it also didn't cost as much. So it's like, I see, like, there are huge advances with that technology and advantages with using it. So it's kind of crazy, you know?
It is crazy.
Let's play something else. What do you want to play next?
Well, man, since we're on Wake Up Hollywood, I think we have to play our song Hollywood Douchebag.
Oh, I love it. It's Hollywood Douchebag by Captain Dangerous.
Hollywood Douchebag. Hollywood Douchebag. Hollywood Douchebag. Hollywood Douchebag. Hollywood Douchebag. Hollywood Douchebag. He will love you like a brother, if that brother your grandmother twice. Hollywood Douchebag. Hollywood Douchebag. Hollywood Douchebag. Hollywood Douchebag. Hollywood Douchebag. Hollywood Douchebag. He's gonna size you up at his first chance. Oh, isn't he nimble in spite of the thimble in his pants? Hollywood Douchebag. Hollywood Douchebag. Hollywood Douchebag. Done with you, you know. He's got-
disguise. Mm-hmm. Are you having fun? Stuck on the 101. Can't find a friend. Stuck there on the 10. Barely alive. Stuck on the 405. Feel like a whore. Stuck on the 134. You know why you came to this town? It was love, sweet love of yourself. While you look around, maybe you'll find something else. You don't have to be a douchebag. Hollywood douchebag. Hollywood douchebag.
A brother, if that brother, your grandmother twice.
That could be my favorite song right now. That is a killer, dude. First of all, I want to make a correction. I said the name of the band was Captain Dangerous. Although they are dangerous, Aaron corrected me. It's Captain Danger, and I apologize. But cool. Man. What a great tune, Hollywood Douchebag. Only somebody from New York could write that song, and thank you for writing it, because it is everything that I would hope a song like that could be. It's awesome. You know, one thing I'm going to give you a huge compliment for is, like, the stuff that you play underneath your vocals. It is really, really kind of, like, decorative and cool and funky and not what is typical of a guitar player or a singer-songwriter to play. And I noticed that when I saw you playing, I'm like, man, you're doing cool voicings, inversions, you're doing cool rhythms. Like, you really are, like, in tune with playing guitar and just doing the vocals too. And that's not easy. It's not an easy feat. So I love the kind of, like, you know, do you intentionally do that when you're writing or when you're kind of, like, coming up with a song or a groove? Do you know that, do you change parts as the bass is coming in? Like, you know, how does that work between when you write it and when you rehearse it?
Yeah, as you just said, sometimes the way you write it, maybe you may play it one way, but as you play with a band, you want to adapt your part to what else is happening. In fact, I think of the guitars being secondary to the drums and the bass and the vocals. It's kind of the last thing, so it should really support all of that stuff. And so it may need a rhythmic thing or a chord thing that's a little different than you started out with.
Love it. Where can people find you online?
CaptainDanger.com is the easiest way to find us, and that'll take you to Instagram, which is Captain Danger Music, and Facebook, and those other things. But if you can remember CaptainDanger.com, you've done it!
That's a pretty catchy name. So it's like, you guys are dangerous. You guys are super funky. We're going to play your last song out. But Aaron, I just want to say thank you so much for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. Your band is awesome. I hope we do many shows together because, man, it's rare when you see a band that is so inspiring like you guys are, and you guys are funky, and it's just amazing. What's the name of the last song we're going to play out?
It's called Come On, Come Along.
Oh, I love it. Here's Come On, Come Along by Captain Danger. Thank you to Aaron Steinberg for being a guest. On behalf of Sam, myself, and Aaron, we'll see you guys next week. Let's get down with this tune. Here we go.
Once again, just because you called up, I never should have done it. But ooh, the flesh gets weak. So come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on.
Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.